Michael Rourke slept through the plane ride, consumed a hot meal while he was debriefed by Allied intelligence personnel in New Caracas, then had his wounds redressed, showered, and changed into German battle dress utilities. 10 minutes later, a selection of weapons flown up from New Germany was shown to him. Knowing his fondness for what he and the rest of the family, individually and collectively, considered real guns, these were reproductions of classic 20th century small arms manufactured in Hawaii by Lancer Corporation. He'd seen Lancer repros before, going to Eden, and was impressed. The exactness of detail, right down to metallurgy, markings, and of course, all functional characteristics, beyond reproduction, more like forgery of the highest order. Somewhere on each piece, artfully hidden, was the Lancer name and corporate logo, a knight on horseback carrying a lance. This was out of necessity. Archaeologists were constantly uncovering relics from the pre-war civilization, and the few antique arms recovered fetched enormous prices on the collector market. To prevent the Lancer guns from being represented as the original articles, they bore their microscopic markings. Michael Rourke's own weapons, among those his two Beretta pistols, were in the custody of his family, and he was certain he would have them back as soon as he and the family were reunited. A German ordnance officer had offered him what he later found out was a year's salary for just one of the Beretta 92Fs, but he refused. From among the Lancer reproductions, he selected a gun with which he had always been fascinated. It was ultimately practical for his use. The gun was an identical duplicate of the one-time widely available, and subsequently banned for importation, 9mm Parabellum Uzi carbine. In his father's firearms reference library and videos, he'd seen the Uzi carbine as rugged, durable, and utilitarian, features he found irresistible. Now he had one, a duplicate of the Type B, the last model imported in the declining years of the 20th century, before misguided do-gooder lawmakers labeled various inanimate objects as evil and proscribed their importation. There were submachine guns available to him, but although selective fire weapons were useful at times, he liked the longer barrel of the semi-automatic carbine. With a variety of magazines, ranging from the short 20-rounders to 32 rounds in length, he felt he was adequately armed for the trip to Hawaii should unforeseen trouble arise. Lancer also made identical duplicate ammunition based on the federal cartridge ammunition his family had always used. He laid up a supply of this as well, having the bulk of the 115-grain jacketed hollow points and most of the magazines sent to the aircraft he would soon be boarding, keeping one primary magazine and two spares with him. An issue German bayonet would do until he had his own knife back. Before boarding the aircraft, he met again with the agents from Allied Intelligence who had briefed him, a man in his 50s with an open, smiling face and a woman in her 30s. She didn't seem to know how to smile properly, but was otherwise pleasant enough, although rather plain. New Caracas was principally a German airbase, with a small town grown up around it. They met in one of the pilot ready rooms. The woman closed the door. Michael sat down, his legs still paining him a little, and the wound in his side bothering him as well. But he was mainly tired.
Herr Rourke, I must commend you for the intelligence coup you have achieved. The data concerning the invasion of Hawaii and the attack on Pearl Harbor seems to check out. But we have no indication how soon the attack is to be launched. Can you remember nothing else?
There was nothing else. When my sister and I were growing up in the retreat, I used to play memory games with myself. I've always been able to memorize things rather easily. If there were any other data, I would have remembered it and told you when I was debriefed.
Then what is your impression? Just the mood of the briefing you were privy to. What do you think their timetable might be? If you had to guess, I mean.
Does this mean I have to guess?
Something subliminal, Herr Rourke, might seem like mere supposition to you, but might be a starting point for us to utilize while we attempt to judge what their timetable might be.
Michael considered that, seeing no harm in giving a guess, but seeing little potential good in it either.
Fine. And this is based on nothing but my gut-level reaction, all right?
That is what we want, Herr Rourke.
I'd say within 2 weeks at the most. But more likely a week.
Why?
It was just vibes.
Vibes, Herr Rourke?
Just a feeling, okay?
A feeling. Good.
If you should remember anything else, of course.
He smiled good-naturedly.
Of course.
The woman opened the door. Michael guessed that meant it was time to leave. But he didn't stand up yet. There was a question he wanted answered.
What about my people?
Your memory is better than mine. I was so concerned with asking you questions that I forgot to tell you something. In approximately 8 minutes, 3 United States Interceptor long-range fighter transports should be making first contacts with the Allied agents whom you encountered in the Wildlands. After that, it is a matter of searching the area in which your family was operating. There are no reports that the interceptors were picked up on Eden defense systems.
Do you know the name of the officer commanding the mission? I mean, I don't know anybody at Midwake or in Hawaii, but I'm just kind of curious.
The woman looked up at the ready room ceiling as though she were consulting a notepad.
The mission is being handled by a United States naval officer, a Commander Shaw.
Well, I hope this Shaw's a good guy.
I am sure, Herrock, that our American allies would have sent the best pilots they had available to head up the mission. Have a safe flight until we meet again, then.
Until we meet again.
John Rourke saw to the horses first, as he'd promised, not trusting Hilda or either of the two others to do as thorough a job of rubbing down the animals as was required. He fed and watered them, seeing to it that their shelter was adequate at least. Then he washed his hands and face, sat down, and consumed 2 packets of field rations and a glass of whiskey. Then he slept. By the black face of the Rolex on his left wrist, he had slept for 1 hour and 12 minutes when Hilda awakened him.
I have just received a transponder signal. The planes are coming here, Doctor.
Good.
Will you want those awful blankets again?
I think not, thank you.
What he wanted was a shower, but there were no facilities, and had there been, there was no time. When he stepped from the outhouse, he saw 3 matte black aircraft, 2 just coming over the horizon, and the 3rd landing in V-stall mode. Emma touched down, Marie Hayes and Wally Theodore flying a low subsonic patrolling pattern that would cover a radius of 50 miles in all directions. If any Eden tanks or APCs or land pirate fortresses were around, Marie and Wally would put them away. Interceptors did not have energy cannons, simply because of the weight, but the missiles on their pods could kill or cripple any Eden armor made, she hoped. At least that was what the instruction booklet that came with the missiles said. She locked down, leaving her engines running, using the excuse of touchdown to unbuckle and stand up. Interceptors had comfortable seats, but nothing was comfortable to sit in without moving. Emma could just as easily have popped her portside hatch remotely, but she didn't, choosing instead to walk back along the length of the fuselage as she removed her helmet and shook her ponytail free. She hit the manual controls and the hatch started to open. There was a man walking toward her, a pack on his back, pistols in his belt. He wore nothing more than a heavy military sweater, slacks, and combat boots. He was tall. He was lean, but from the way he looked, he was also well-muscled and athletic. His face was thin, too, with not an ounce of fat on it, the bone structure solid and strong. His mouth was wide, with lines at the corners that looked like enormous dimples as the sides turned down. His hair was dark brown with a little bit of gray in patches, which became more noticeable the nearer he got. His hairline was strong, although his forehead was high. He looked like he was normally clean-shaven, but wasn't now. She could not see his eyes. Sunlight glinted on the snow, and he wore old-style aviator-type sunglasses, presumably against the glare. He looked handsomer than he did in all of his pictures, in all the statues. This was John Thomas Rourke, the God made flesh. John Rourke neared the fuselage door. There was a tall, thin, beautiful woman with auburn hair and incredibly long legs standing in the open doorway. He reminded himself that this was the future, so to speak, and it was wholly possible for a woman to be the co-pilot or navigator on a military fighter aircraft. Women generally had better reflexes than men and made excellent pilots. He started to shrug out of his pack as he walked, catching it up under his arm as he neared the doorway, then throwing it inside as the woman looked down.
General Rourke, this is a true privilege.
If you've got to call me anything besides John, Dr. Rourke's better, okay? But I really prefer John, and you're Miss...
I'm Commander Emma Shaw, sir. I'll reiterate, this is a genuine pleasure, sir.
As he started to climb aboard, she reached out a hand and he took it.
Can I see the pilot, Commander? We have to make some time.
Sir, I hope you are not displeased, but I am the pilot. In fact, I'm the mission commander.
Now the pretty eyes look downright hard.
Oh, no, Commander, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing at me. I must look pretty stupid with egg all over my face. Or do they still even use that expression?
We still use it, sir. And yes, sir, I do see a little egg there, now that you mention it.
Rourke extended his right hand to her.
How about John, okay?
Emma.
Emma, I think I can guide you to the others. You have medical supplies, food, warm clothing aboard?
Your son, John, your son contacted the Navy through Allied Intelligence. We're fully equipped and...
Michael's all right?
As far as I know, sir. But I'm fully briefed, except for the identity of your prisoner.
Good for Michael, John Rourke thought. Alive and keeping Martin Zimmer in the bag. Or perhaps the information was only withheld from her. There was no way to tell. John Rourke decided that it was the right moment to show some trust.
Prisoner is Martin Zimmer. He's the leader of Eden, and he was born exactly 125 years ago, even though he's only 30. He looks more like me, but more like my son. Michael was impersonating him.
Holy shit, sir.
Yeah, precisely, Commander. Precisely. Now, maybe we should get airborne and find the rest of the people you're supposed to rescue. Hopefully, the cold will be their only problem.
Whatever the problem, sir, short of the entire Eden Air Force, you don't have anything to worry about. We got in, we'll get them, and we'll get out. Then I fly you and your family and the freed female prisoners to my ship, which is anchored off Port Reno, Nevada. Drop off the freed prisoners, then fly you and whomever else you direct to come along to Hawaii.
Hawaii?
Your guess is as good as mine, sir.
How old are you?
What, sir?
Please.
30, sir.
Well, please stop calling me sir, because I was born over 6.5 centuries ago, and I feel old enough, okay?
Dietrich Zimmer had several choices. The segmented geodesic dome above him sheltered an array of plants, ranging from those once found in abundance in tropical rainforests to those of the northern tundra. The plants were coming back, but not yet as before. He had never seen before, but he had read, watched tapes, and studied all he could about them. He had always considered himself a Socratic man. Sometimes his greatest lament was that life was not long enough to learn everything. If only it had been possible to acquire knowledge while he'd taken cryogenic sleep. He could have known all there was to learn of human knowledge, but then he still would have been merely scratching the surface. There was so much yet to learn. He chose the tropical rainforest segment of this domed paradise. As he walked in the rooftop garden, he considered his alternatives. This was a moment of history, and whatever decision he made would echo through the vaults of the future. So that decision must be a good one, the very best. Martin was most likely still a prisoner of the Rourke family. John Rourke would not kill his own son, of course, and even if he entertained the thought, Martin would be safe as long as Sarah Rourke hovered between life and death, and the only person who could free her was Dietrich Zimmer. Sooner or later, John Rourke would get word to him, suggesting a trade of sorts. Martin in exchange for certain services. So Dietrich Zimmer dismissed thoughts of Martin, although he could not dismiss the anxiety he felt. Because Martin was his son, regardless of whose loins he sprang from, he considered the immediately pressing matter of the attack on the United States fleet at Pearl Harbor. The great preponderance of United States sea and air power was to be found at Pearl Harbor. Michael Rourke had sat through a briefing, so presumably Allied intelligence knew of the plan, or soon would, in as much detail as was divulged. Four choices, then, lay before him. He could cancel the attack, postpone the attack, accelerate the attack's timetable, or go ahead as planned with the attack's existing timetable. If he went ahead as planned, the Transglobal Alliance would never have sufficient time to prepare, regardless of knowing that the attack was coming. And so much was already in motion to turn plans and contingencies into reality. He paused, considering a hibiscus.
Lovely.
The fight with Michael Rourke in Martin's suite, there was something odd about it. Dietrich Zimmer had survived all these years by never trusting anyone or anything. And just because they shared similar political, philosophical, and racial beliefs didn't mean he trusted Kronberg and this current crop of SS. Kronberg's people knew nothing of science and reality. More than a year ago, Kronberg had enthused wildly over the absurd pseudoscience that was popular within the Third Reich. The universe, Kronberg said, was made of fire and ice, and only the Earth combined the two. But did Kronberg believe this nonsense? Or was he merely trying to disarm fears for his, Kronberg's, intellectual abilities? Once the war was begun and had its own momentum, the time would be right to cleanse the party of persons he did not trust, persons who might work against Martin's inherent superiority. Kronberg and his fellows had a fondness for the history of the Third Reich. Dietrich Zimmer wondered how well they remembered the Night of the Long Knives in 1934, when Hitler rid himself of his brown shirts. Perhaps Kronberg recalled it all too well. Perhaps Kronberg sought to prevent history from repeating itself by destroying his Führer before he could destroy him. If that were the case, then Kronberg and his entire SS were potentially deadly enemies, more to be reckoned with than the military forces of the Transglobal Alliance that stood against Eden's destiny. There was time, because the beginning of the war would consume all energies, consume all minds. Dietrich Zimmer walked on, entering the segment where there was desert plant life. A barrel cactus flowered amid the sand. The air here was so dry compared to the humidity of the rainforest segment that his sinuses began to react. He would leave the dome and return to Martin's suite. There was to be a meeting with Kronberg and the others. Dietrich Zimmer's decisions were made about the attack on Pearl Harbor, about Kronberg's eventual fate, and even about what he would do when John Rourke presented him with the inevitable offer. He would accept. John Rourke's honor would not allow that a truce be violated. Martin would be safe for the moment, and Rourke would find even greater sorrow because his wife would be restored to him, but her mind would be gone. While extracting the bullet, Zimmer would see to that. From the medical records he had studied of the incident, with his skill and his instruments, he could extract the bullet, leaving Sarah Rourke unimpaired and fully restored. But as he removed the bullet, it would be very easy to allow his instruments to slip, a bit this way, a bit that way. Dietrich Zimmer would see to that. What better punishment than to give John Rourke a drooling imbecile to care for while the world around him collapsed into defeat for everything in which he believed? He had won against John Rourke 125 years ago, and he would win again now. Life could be greater punishment than death, and so it would be with John Rourke. When this war was won, let Rourke live. Lock him away with a wife without a mind. Let his mind and all he was dissolve to dust. That was true revenge.
I know this is a silly question, Dr. Rourke, but how does it feel to be you? I mean...
John Rourke was more interested in studying the cockpit of the Interceptor, or possibly in some sleep. But instead, he was studying the terrain zipping by beneath them. The last thing he wanted to talk about with this young woman was himself, but he tried to be polite and truthful with her.
I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, or the wrong place at the wrong time, depending on one's perspective, Commander.
Please, Emma.
Right, Emma.
But I mean, you must be aware of the pivotal role you played. Without you, at least according to what the history books and the movies all say, I mean...
Movies?
Haven't you seen Lance, what's it, play you? I mean, even though the film was made in Eden and it's loaded with propaganda, I mean, it was terrific.
Wait, what sort of propaganda?
She didn't answer for a moment.
What sort of propaganda?
I thought you'd seen the thing. Well, they have you spouting off a lot about anti-Semitic stuff.
What?
And your son-in-law, Paul Rubinstein. In the movie, he came from Jewish grandparents but disowned them. And what brought the two of you together was this thing in the past about the...
No, don't tell me.
But don't worry. There's a movie in production in Hawaii right now with Brad Lang. He's a real hunk. And he's a pretty good actor.
She must have realized what she just said, Rourke surmised, because what he could see of her cheeks past the outline of her helmet seemed to be reddening in a blush. He found that sweet, somehow.
Anyway, I was reading that they wanted to film on location, but Eden wouldn't allow it unless the government had editorial control of the script. They'd got this terrific guy to play Rubinstein, I understand. He's an unknown, but they auditioned more than 100 actors until they found just the right one. Say, wouldn't they owe you money? I mean, making a film about your life and everything?
It's probably public domain. And although sometime I'm sure I'll need to find a way of making money again, at the moment I have no need for it.
You don't know?
I don't know what.
It was in the intel stuff when I went through before the mission. You're still on the role of officers as a Brigadier General. That means they must owe you some money for a...
No. That was honorary. It's just something done at the time. I never took it seriously. I wore that uniform exactly once. The night.
Memories of that night. The night Akira Kuranami and Elaine Halverson celebrated their wedding. The last night he'd seen Sarah alive flooded back to him. He looked away from this talkative woman and studied the ground even more intently. If he had been a little quicker, hadn't let Sarah go to the clinic alone, hadn't...
What did I say?
The only time I wore my uniform was the night my son, now Martin Zimmer, was born. And my wife was shot in the head. And I wound up wearing quite a bit of my clinic's construction materials all over me. And went into a coma that I didn't awaken from for 125 years. They're gonna put that in the movie, huh? How I screwed up?
He still didn't look at her, and Emma was silent for a moment. John Rourke was beginning to realize that silence on this woman's part was exceedingly rare, so he didn't attempt to break it. As he expected, she did.
I did a term paper on you once. That was when the official version was that you and your family were all dead. As far as I understood it, your clinic was firebombed and you went inside to rescue people and were trapped in the debris from an explosion.
That's more or less the way it happened, except I should have been there earlier and then none of it would have...
I read that a heavily armed force of Nazi commandos was responsible for it. What could one man have done?
They were passing over the seven buildings that were the miserable excuse for a town, where John Rourke had shot it out with Marianne's old man and a number of the fellow's associates.
Could have made a difference. Bear south from here along that ridge line and keep that to your right.
She didn't say anything for a moment, then brought her radio up to her mouth.
Do not acknowledge this transmission by radio. This is Aloha Leader. Prepare to enter into mode beta. I say again, mode beta. On my mark. 4, 3.
Her hands seemed to fly more rapidly over the interceptor's controls than the plane itself flew over the rugged terrain beneath them.
2, 1, mark.
She pulled the Velcro tab and the mouthpiece for her radio fell away as she started the machine into a steep bank, the portside wing tipping downward, the aircraft's attitude nearly 90 degrees to the hard deck.
Hold on, Dr. Rourke. We're going right up one of Eden Defense Command's sensor alleys for the next, make that 94 seconds. We'll be flying in a manner that will seem rather erratic to you, I'm afraid.
As all the blood started flowing to the left side of his body, he caught the edge of a wingtip through the starboard side of the cockpit over the right wing. The other two aircraft seemed to be flying off at tangents to this one.
We're so fast, Doctor, that my wingmen will take up positions better than a mile off in each direction. That way, a sensor fix won't catch all of us, and whoever might get caught has a better chance of evading a hit. A lot more maneuvering room, and the possibility that one or both of the other two aircraft can disable an incoming. But relax, we can outrun any missile they've got, or at least as far as we know, and we can maneuver right alongside one.
Let's not do that unless we can't avoid it, okay?
I'm not implying we're invincible, but if we can avoid getting picked up by two missiles at once, we've got a real chance of evading a hit. And with any luck, we'll get in and out without getting spotted. At least, so far so good.
Terrain following, they were at relatively low speed, but he estimated they should be spotting Annie, Paul, Natalia, and the others in under 60 seconds, unless something had gone radically wrong. Annie Rubinstein looked up.
Oh, God!
There was a black shape coming in fast from the south. It was an aircraft, but looked like none she had ever seen before. It was the shape of a fighter plane, but considerably larger. Its wings, although it was hard to tell from her perspective, almost appearing to be swept forward.
Paul! Natalia! Overhead!
Annie choked up on the reins of the two horses she led, following the aircraft with her eyes as it streaked overhead. As her eyes followed the aircraft, it was banking to starboard now almost unbelievably rapidly. She saw the faces of the women who rode the horses she led. There was terror in their eyes. Natalia ran beside Martin Zimmer, urging him to move faster by prodding his ribcage with the muzzle of her assault rifle.
Now, get down here!
Try anything and I will kill you.
The aircraft was touching down on the snowfield in the V-stall mode. Paul Rubinstein dropped down beside his wife.
Now you stay here.
The plane was unmarked, a dull matte black. Steam blew off its engine cowlings. A door opened on the port side of the fuselage. Paul Rubinstein threw himself flat into the snow, the Schmeisser up to his shoulder. Range was satisfactory to use it, and he was more confident with this weapon than with any of the new long arms they were given. A man stepped out of the doorway.
Hi, honeys. I'm home.
It was the first time John Rourke had seen this coastline from the air in any real detail, and it shocked him. On the night of the war, the major fault lines in California slipped, and there was earthquake activity beyond measurement, much of California falling away. Mountain passes became fjords like those in Norway. Low-lying desert became ocean. Millions of people died. Port Reno, Nevada was the butt end of a long fjord, which was among the busiest shipping areas in the world. The fjord and the harbor into which it led a natural protection against storms. It was also the perfect place for submarines. The newest vessels of the United States fleet were a magnificent sight to behold. They were enormous by any previously considered standard, but size aside, their versatility was what amazed John Rourke the most. The vessels combined the attributes of submarine and aircraft carrier at once, and they were capable of surface or submerged operation with equal grace. They were the concept of the seagoing fighting ship taken to an inevitable conclusion, which began centuries before the birth of Christ.
Oh, what a Viking or a Phoenician would have done with one of these.
Like they say, you ain't seen nothing yet, Doctor.
Emma took down a small microphone that nested in an overhead console.
This is Commander Shaw. All personnel, please check seat restraints. We will be accomplishing air-sea transition in approximately 2 minutes.
Transition. As a physician 6 centuries ago, when I used the word transition, it usually meant that the termination of pregnancy was imminent, and the expectant mother, if her husband was within earshot, occasionally became rather nasty.
We're airborne now, of course, and we could land on the deck of one of the vessels that has surfaced, but our orders are to land on one that isn't.
We're going to land on a submerged runway?
We're going to land in a submerged dock, Doc.
How?
Well, interceptors are versatile, as I told you. But we can shift from air mobile to sea mobile. Consequently, the aircraft becomes a mini sub of sorts. But interceptors aren't designed to be used as submarines, of course. What the dual capabilities means is that we can travel underwater and dock underwater. Look at it in the context of a naval battle. We've got enemy ships all around us, right? What do we do to launch aircraft to attack those surface ships and save everybody's bacon? Easy. We'll launch our planes while submerged. The planes will travel out of the battle zone while in the underwater mode, then accomplish a sea-air transition into the air. Now, a missile can knock out a conventional aircraft trying to get away from a conventional aircraft carrier because the aircraft is so much involved in takeoff procedures and it's traveling relatively slowly along a fixed path. We're out the door and gone before they know it, and when we come out of the water, we can be at Mach 2 in under 60 seconds.
She checked a timer on her console, then spoke through the hand microphone.
I know none of you have done this before, but trust me, we'll be fine. Sorry there aren't any portholes for you to look out, because even after all the times I've done this, I still feel like saying, wow. Remember, don't induce heat restraints until we're docked and I give the okay. I've never been pregnant, so I don't know much about the other kind of transition, but I'll take your word for it, Doctor.
Yeah, so long as you know about this kind, I'll be perfectly happy.
The water was coming up fast, and it didn't look as though the interceptor was slowing at all. Marie Hayes was a pretty girl, her softly arranged hair, parted in the middle, so brown it was almost black. Her skin was flawless and fair, her eyes as dark a brown as her hair. She looked almost fragile, and despite the helmet that covered her hair now, and the mannish-looking flight suit and bomber jacket she wore, she seemed terribly feminine. Natalia Tyomarovna occupied the co-pilot's seat beside Marie Hayes. But her eyes weren't on Marie Hayes at all. After the first few minutes of being airborne, Natalia decided that she and the 8 freed captives were in perfectly safe hands.
We're accomplishing air-sea transition, Major. Don't be alarmed. When I told our passengers there was nothing to it, I meant it. But it is kind of fun.
Natalia reserved judgment on that. The aircraft, piloted by Commander Shaw, seemed to skate over the water, then disappear in a great white foamy wake. Natalia braced herself as Marie Hayes leveled off, then dipped the interceptor's nose slightly.
Hitting the salt deck, Major. The fun starts now.
Suddenly, a wake of ocean water surrounded them to port and starboard. The interceptor's nose cut through into the apex of the wedge and downward, water rolling over the canopy surrounding them. Marie Hayes' hands were virtually flying over the controls as Natalia glanced toward the woman for reassurance. The ocean surrounded them, but they were still moving, almost as fast, it seemed, as before, broad arcs of landing lights illuminating the water ahead, schools of fish scurrying from their path. The interceptor banked, just as it would in the air, course-correcting. And ahead of them, there was an incredibly bright light. The light grew brighter and brighter, and there was a shape behind the light, hulking, enormous. Then they were past the light, the interceptor slowing almost imperceptibly at first. The shape took greater definition now. More lights spread ahead of them. The shape was an enormous, flooded docking bay. What little she could see of the color, rust brown except for the runway surface. And now the interceptor slowed dramatically, then stopped, moving forward only slightly in the current that it generated, touching down on the runway surface. Marie Hayes snatched her microphone from the overhead nest.
We've touched down and everything is fine. We have one more interceptor to bring in, then the compartment will be pressurized. That'll take a few minutes. See? A snap. But it's neat.
But Natalia was fascinated. She stared. The docking bay was enormous. Well off in the distance, farther inboard, through the still swirling waters, she could see more aircraft, as if waiting there. She could not tell that aircraft belonged to Commander Shaw.
Look around there over to your right, and you'll see Wally Theodore coming in.
Natalia Tyomarovna had always thought that once all sense of wonder was gone, it would be time to lay down and die. She felt that sense of wonder now. She could see the aircraft coming through the water toward them at what looked like enormous speed. Landing lights brightly illumined, the water seeming to part around it because of the speed at which it traveled. Logically, she knew that speed couldn't be too great because the resistance of the water would have torn off the wings. But still, she thought. And then the interceptor stopped, darker against the gray blackness, hovering there, then touching down as gently as a bird might come to rest on a branch. And it was on the deck. Natalia thought something was wrong, but she was still looking toward the entrance to the bay, and in the diffused light she could see doors, enormous like everything else here, starting to close, but not in any conventional manner. Each door was like the iris of a camera, a series of comparatively small panels fanning outward and sealing away the ocean itself.
Might want to swallow a little. Sometimes they pressurize a little too fast.
Jets of compressed air blew against the water, lowering the level just above the cockpit canopy now, then rolling away on both sides. Natalia swallowed hard to equalize the mounting air pressure as Marie Hayes activated toggle switches on an overhead panel and tiny jets of air blew into the cockpit. The waters around them receded now. Natalia could make out the first aircraft, the one Commander Shaw flew. Marie Hayes started out of her seat.
We're okay now, Major.
Natalia, please.
Natalia, then.
Natalia unbuckled and followed Marie Hayes aft. None of the women rescued from the land pirates had ever flown before, as far as Natalia could determine. This must have been beyond belief.
Okay, ladies. We'll be able to open up in another couple of seconds. Now, the deck can be a little slippery, and boy, does it hurt when you fall on it. So be careful stepping out.
Natalia followed Marie to the door. Marie stepped aside, and Natalia stood in the doorway. This was how she imagined the future when she was a little girl. Technology, vast and wonderful. The docking bay was a hangar of huge proportions, and overhead vaulted and sprawling above, steel glistening and wet. Steps began folding out of the fuselage. Natalia took them, stopped on the last tread, and stared. Air currents still blew across the deck, drying the larger puddles away. Excess water channeled into gutters fore and aft. Natalia stepped onto the deck. She looked toward the interceptor flown by the third pilot, Wally Theodore. Annie was stepping down from it onto the deck. Behind her was Martin Zimmer, with Paul close behind him, gun drawn. Natalia looked toward the first aircraft. John stood in the doorway. She knew him well. He was amazed, as was she. John started down the steps, setting foot on the deck. Natalia waved. John waved back. She looked up at Marie Hayes.
Do you think I'll be able to get permission to learn to fly one of these?
I don't see why not, Major.
That thought was delicious. Natalia savored it. In a few moments, there would be time enough to worry over everything else. Michael was safe, she knew. Soon they would be together. Evidently, Eden's war plans were being accelerated. There were still the problems attendant upon trading Martin Zimmer to Dietrich Zimmer in return for Dietrich's surgical skills being used to save Sarah. But for now, wonderment was enough. John Rourke submitted to a physical examination, but merely a cursory one, in order to satisfy the captain of this vessel, his host, that a little cold weather and some time in the wildlands was not potentially fatal. But it was done more to convince 22 of the women that letting a real doctor examine them was not tantamount to ritual suicide. Marianne numbly did what she thought was expected of her, and the 24th woman, injured during the crash of the helicopter, was either equally as compliant or fatalistic enough to realize she had no real choice. The exam over, Rourke found a shower and stood under it for a very long time, washing his hair and body several times before he really felt clean. Fresh clothes from his pack, his face clean-shaven, he felt like a new man. He, Annie, Paul, and Natalia were scheduled for a flight to Hawaii, leaving within the hour, but there was a briefing scheduled before that in Captain Ron's office. John Rourke arrived before any of the other members of the family and was immediately ushered into Ron's office. Ron stood at attention behind his desk.
General Rourke, I must apologize for not being available to welcome you personally.
He came around the desk and offered his hand. Rourke took it.
Captain, I'm not really much used to being called a general, simply because I never considered myself to be one. And any and all apologies are accepted. I knew your ancestor, Admiral Ron. He was a fine and intelligent man. I was very pleased to learn that his family has carried on such a splendid tradition of service to the country.
Well, thank you, sir. Would you care for a seat?
Rourke nodded and sat down. Captain Ron sat down as well.
Major T.M. Narova and Mr. and Mrs. Rubenstein, sir.
Rourke stood for the two women, waited until the shakes and pleasantries were exchanged and the women were seated, then sat down again. Captain Ron stood and walked across the room toward a good-sized video screen mounted on an interior bulkhead. He glanced at a diver's watch on his left wrist and seemed to compare it to a military time diode counter beneath the screen.
There is a video transmission from Fleet Admiral Hayes just about now. We're still working on scrambling high-security satellite video, and sometimes it's like this. My apologies.
The picture cleared, not perfectly, but rather like UHF antenna reception on a sunny day. It was perfectly visible, if rather imperfect in resolution. The woman on the screen, somewhere in her middle 50s, as Rourke judged her, was attractive, and the resemblance between Admiral Hayes and her niece, whom Rourke had met briefly in the landing bay, was pronounced.
Dr. Rourke. This is a true privilege, sir.
Pleasure's mine, Admiral. May I introduce my family? To my right is my daughter Annie, Mrs. Rubenstein. Beside her, her husband and my friend, Paul Rubenstein. The lovely woman to my right is Major Natalia Tiamarovna.
This is like strolling through the pages of a history book.
John Rourke was beginning to feel like a cross between Methuselah and one of the mammoths in General Verikov's office without walls in Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History.
I'm looking forward to meeting with all of you personally at Pearl Harbor. I'm at Midwake for the moment, but should arrive in Hawaii shortly after all of you do. I have a lovely house overlooking the ocean. I was born in Midwake, and I have a fondness for the ocean. I'd love all of you to come and share the view with me, and dinner as well at your earliest convenience.
I'm certain, Admiral, that I speak for my entire family and my son Michael as well, when I say that it would be our privilege, and we eagerly await your invitation.
She smiled. Rourke smiled.
What are your plans concerning Martin Zimmer?
He goes with us.
He is the head of state of Eden, Doctor. Are you sure that...
The man who raised him, Admiral Hayes, unless I am mistaken, is the only man in the world who has a prayer of saving the life of my wife. When I first was awakened from cryogenic sleep after emerging from my coma, I made it my business to research as quickly as possible what progress medical science had made in the years while I slept. Indeed, that progress was astonishing. However, to the best I was able to ascertain, medical science had not perfected the skills necessary, surgical procedure, shall we say, that would enable my wife to be brought back among the living. Dr. Dietrich Zimmer possessed these skills more than a century ago, and he still does. As long as I have Martin Zimmer, I can force Dietrich Zimmer to save the life of my wife. Without Martin, my wife is doomed to cryogenic sleep, perhaps for years, perhaps for decades, perhaps forever. I have no choice.
What if I were to order you to release him?
Order away, madam. No offense intended. He'll be released prematurely. Over my dead body.
Mine as well.
Oz!
I understand. Through a similar conversation with your son, who has just landed at Pearl, by the way, that Martin Zimmer is also your son?
My wife was shot in the head by Dietrich Zimmer only a few moments after bearing our third child. That child was a boy. Dietrich Zimmer kidnapped the infant son, only a few hours older, of Lieutenant Martha Larrymore, one of the Eden survivors. It was assumed Lieutenant Larrymore's child died in the clinic fire and explosions. That was not the case. When Dietrich Zimmer murdered a baby before the eyes of my children, my son-in-law, and Major Tiemirovna, it was erroneously assumed that the baby was the child to whom my wife gave birth. DNA typing and other similar tests were not available. In reality, the son of Martha Larrymore was murdered instead. Zimmer raised Sarah and my son as his own, inculcating Nazism in the lad, but also tampering with his genetic structure somehow. My knowledge of genetic microsurgery is a bit remiss, I'm afraid, but I intend to add to it at my first opportunity. However, you may rest assured I have no intention of murdering Martin Zimmer for the moment. If I am able to make a deal with Dietrich Zimmer, I will keep my part of the bargain. Martin will be returned. But since I helped to bring Martin Zimmer into the world, I feel it is incumbent upon me to help rid the world of his evil. My eventual intentions are not at issue currently. I hope I fully answered your questions.
For the record, Doctor, should we attempt to have Martin Zimmer return to Eden, you would prevent it to the best of your ability?
I would endeavor to prevent it, Admiral, to an extent you might not well be able to imagine. This, I swear.
Until later then, sir.
Hawaii. Palm trees on the white sand beaches, unspoiled highlands rich in vegetation, snow-capped mountains, a live volcano building more of the islands every moment. He had never before visited there. Michael's father had evidently been a fan of Tom Selleck, and at the retreat had several episodes of the actor's long-running television series recorded, along with several of his films. The television series was set in Hawaii. Until now, that was the only image of Hawaii Michael Rourke had had. The palms still swayed, but the breezes were apparently not quite so balmy. Aloha shirts were in evidence. There were civilian employees at Pearl Harbor, but this traditional attire was augmented by a windbreaker over it or a turtleneck under it. In one case, Michael Rourke actually saw an aloha-patterned sweater. He had wanted to walk to stretch his legs after the long and boring flight from New Caracas to Honolulu. A technique was used, apparently commonplace now, that he remembered reading about in a science magazine as a young boy. The aircraft on which he had traveled merely climbed into the upper atmosphere, then reinserted, reducing flight time dramatically. But it was still too long. He wanted to be active, move about, to work the kinks out of his wounded legs. He'd requested some time from the Navy brass who'd met him just to walk about the base and familiarize himself with the place. He was assigned a pretty young red-headed ensign to escort him around the base. Pearl Harbor, along with all other structures on the islands, was swept clean by the fires of the Great Conflagration, so nothing remained except, curiously, some minor bits of wreckage from the battleship Arizona, sunk during the original attack by the Japanese on December 7, 1941. A new monument to it had been built. This, one of the first spots on the tour the young ensign, her name was Harriet Collins, was apparently giving him, whether he wanted a tour or not. But he was enjoying it. Aside from vaguely remembered trips as a boy before the night of the war, he had never been a tourist. Marine and naval personnel were everywhere, and security at the facility seemed tight. No one was without an identity badge, and as the lieutenant commander had told him, everyone was armed. They left the memorial, taking a launch to the far side of the base where the airfield was situated. The airfield stretched farther than he could see, hangars flanking it on two sides, several control towers, various radar and other sensing installations in evidence. There were six principal runways, she told him, and during scramble drills it was possible to launch an aircraft every 39 seconds. Pearl Harbor seemed ready, but Michael wondered if it was ready enough. Kronberg's plans to use sabotage to knock out power facilities, communications, and cause general disruption, coupled with an electromagnetic pulse over the fleet, might make all these preparations useless. Air defenses would be blinded, the aircraft on the ground and in the air within reach of the pulse would be dead until major repairs from shielded parts could be accomplished, and it would be down to guns, knives, and knuckles to defend these islands, and the free world. As before in history, the United States was the linchpin of an alliance against a terrible aggressor. Should the United States, Hawaii, and Midwake in this century fail, the alliance would certainly crumble. Which was, of course, what Martin and Dietrich Zimmer and Kroenberg and all the others counted on. John Rourke sat in the co-pilot seat of the Interceptor, reading from a video screen that was set into a folding console. What he was reading was the Intel Digest concerning his son Michael's report on the forthcoming attack on Pearl Harbor. Michael had not only acted bravely, but also well. Both of his children had grown to be people of whom he was terribly and justifiably proud. Over the ages, various philosophers had held a cyclical view of history, and history, it seemed, was bearing out their contentions. But it was also apparent that missed opportunities were gone forever, somehow escaping the cycle of repetition. If, following Germany's surrender at the close of World War II, those who had championed the idea of destroying world communism had been heeded, the hostilities between the United States and communist nations could have been avoided, together with suffering on both sides. John Rourke recalled a conversation he had once had with a particularly bright and perceptive 15-year-old, a young man. In that fellow's case, the appellation boy would have been grossly inappropriate. Discussing the geopolitical situation at the time, Rourke had the usual adult prejudice. Listen to the young person, certainly, but learning from him would be highly improbable. The young man had voiced an opinion that was at once ruthless and practical. What was the sense in fighting a bitter and protracted war, conquering an enemy nation, then financing the rebuilding of said nation's economy, when it might potentially become an enemy power once again? Certainly help in the rebuilding, but toward a better purpose. Further exploring this idea with the young man, there was no evidence of malice in the fellow's thinking. Punishing a former enemy was not only inhumane, but also counterproductive. Why not simply bring that nation into the fold, as it were? A bit simplistic, yes, Rourke thought at the time. But when considered in the light of the form of government of the United States, as opposed to less free states, the idea of imposing such a comparatively enlightened form of government on a conquered nation that was annexed had considerable merit, most particularly to the conquered nation. This was not a perfect solution, certainly, nor was it perfect when the Romans had indeed practiced it, imposing the Pax Romana on the then known world. But the Roman system was vastly less close to perfection than the American system. Had the United States and her allies taken this additional step following World War II, none of what ensued would have happened. John Rourke didn't consider himself politically naive, and any solution viewed simplistically was dangerous. Divisiveness could have arisen between the Allies, to be sure, and there might have been other unforeseen pitfalls. Yet none of this could conceivably have been worse than what did happen. But perhaps the United States of those days was too politically self-conscious, rather like the pretty girl at a party who doesn't realize she's pretty at all, and instead of dancing every dance, becomes a wallflower. Was it modesty or a lack of self-confidence? The world was heading into a new epoch of mortal conflict, more rapidly perhaps than this ultra-modern aircraft sped over the Pacific now. 625 years ago, he had been unable to do anything, unable to prevent a war that nearly destroyed all of humanity and the very fabric of the planet. This time, he would not fail. It was a silent pledge John Rourke made, to himself and to his God. Such a pledge, although often the most difficult to fulfill, was the hardest to break. This war would not happen while any honorable means presented itself by which the conflict could be prevented, and breath remained in his body to work toward that end. Conciliation to tyranny was incomprehensible to him, as well as objectively futile. So he would make peace by destroying those who would inflict war once again on humanity. He looked away from the screen and realized that Emma Shaw was watching him.
Something wrong?
No, I was just looking at you. I'm sorry. It was rude of me, I guess.
Rourke didn't know what to say. But as he had learned, silence was nothing Emma Shaw allowed to last.
I'm a shameless hussy.
What? I haven't heard that word in years.
Women are more direct these days, Doctor. I like you.
Well, I like you too.
No, I mean, I like you.
I don't follow you.
We're heading into a war, Doctor. One of these babies can outrun or outfight almost anything, but accidents happen. Life expectancy's close to 100 these days, in case you didn't know. But people still die, all the time. I learned a long time ago that life isn't something you can count on to be there.
that the breath you have inside of you might be the last breath you'll ever experience. So I figured it was best to be honest. When I was a little girl, I used to say the damnedest things. I know my parents must have wanted to dig a hole sometimes and crawl into it out of sheer embarrassment. I guess I haven't changed much. And I know saying this to a man like you is perfectly silly, but if you're ever lonely, you don't have to be alone.
She looked away. John Rourke said nothing. The idea was a little amusing. Not what she'd just said, that was sweet. But the realization her words brought to him was what amused him. Perhaps he should have consulted with that rather astute 15-year-old concerning advice about women, too. By circumstance alone, the most confusing and morally troubling relationship of his entire life had been resolved. Natalia was Michael's now. He'd never thought he wanted to be free of her, and he still loved her and always would. But he was free now, free to be Sarah's husband when she was revived, restored to him. Emma Shaw was not only pretty, in a much earthier, less incredible way than Natalia, but she was also attractive to him as a person. He liked independent women. He'd never cared for a woman who shrank from life, was afraid of challenge. But never again. Michael Rourke stood on the runway as the fuselage door of the first of three unmarked interceptors to land opened and his father stepped out. John Rourke smiled, and as he moved down the steps, almost in the same instant in which they folded out, he unslung a medium-sized black duffel bag, just carrying it in his hand. He stopped about 2 feet from Michael, setting down the bag.
You did well, son.
John Rourke extended his right hand. Michael Rourke clasped it. Then John Rourke's smile broadened even more.
You're not too old. Give me a hug, damn it.
And they embraced quickly, each stepping back from the other, Michael feeling a smile breaking out on his face. John Rourke nodded his head toward the black duffel.
Got your handguns and your knife there. Figured you might need them. Nice Uzi carbine. Reproduction?
One of the Lancers.
Yours or borrowed?
Germans gave it to me.
A very underappreciated firearm in its day, that semi-automatic carbine. Have to let me try it sometime. Hey, you did well with playing spy. I understand you took one getting away.
The wind blew hard and cool over the tarmac as Natalia climbed down out of one of the aircraft. Michael wanted to take her into his arms.
Like they say in the movies, just nick me. I'm fine.
John Rourke glanced back over his shoulder.
So, what are you waiting for?
Michael didn't understand.
Natalia, son. But don't forget to give your sister a hug and say hi to Paul, huh?
Can you,
Yeah, I'll get the bag dropped off in your quarters. Go on.
Michael nodded, clapped his father on the shoulder, then broke into a hobbling run across the field toward Natalia. His right hand held the Uzi against his body so it wouldn't pendulum against him as he moved. Natalia saw him and started walking, then running into his arms.
Michael!
Her arms went around his neck and he crushed her against him, kissing her harder than he'd ever kissed her, then just holding her. John Thomas Rourke watched Michael and Natalia. What they had seemed very good. He picked up the duffel bag and started to walk toward the knot of naval brass about 100 yards distant. Annie Rourke Rubenstein had left Martin Zimmer handcuffed to one of the structural supports in the cabin bulkhead. Unless he was a magician, he wasn't going anywhere. She stood halfway down the egress steps, Paul already standing on the tarmac. Over her husband's right shoulder, she watched her father. Her skirts caught in the cool breeze off the sea. Annie lifted her clothing with her left hand as she walked down the remaining steps and stood beside Paul, felt him reach out and take her hand. The wind had her hair too, but she did nothing to fight it, merely leaning her head against her husband's shoulder.
I love you.
I know.
I feel so sorry for him.
You did?
Uh-huh. He's so alone. I have you. Michael has Natalia. He doesn't have anybody.
She felt Paul exhale, felt his hand gently turn her arm behind her and his arm bind her to him.
Your mother's down, but not out. They'll make things right, and they'll have each other.
I don't think so.
Psychic flash?
If anyone else had said it that way, Annie would have thought she was being made fun of. But Paul never did that.
No. Not even woman's intuition. Maybe just odds for and against. But even if he gets her back somehow, I don't think he'll keep her.
Sarah never...
It's different with you and me. And for Michael and Natalia, too. It's not the same for them. They love each other, but... I don't think they like each other. And I think Dad knows it. And so did Mom.
Sufficient unto each day is the evil thereof.
Annie didn't say anything. She hoped Paul was right. She prayed he was right. Emma Shaw watched John Rourke. She stood in the doorway, her helmet off, the rubber band out of her hair, which was blowing in the wind. She'd made a fool out of herself. Dr. Rourke had been very polite, but she knew it anyway. Maybe they'd never see each other again. She rubbed the fingers of her right hand against her palm. She wanted to fly with John Rourke very badly. More than she'd ever wanted anything in her life. She stopped before a group of officers, both Naval and Marine Corps. Where were the brass bands and the red carpets? He was a living legend, come back from near death to try to save the world one more time, mankind's reluctant, quiet champion. And Emma Shaw wondered if they appreciated that. Because of all the impressions her few hours with Dr. John Thomas Rourke engendered in her, the most indelible was that he was a quiet man who merely wanted to live his life. Fate just refused to allow that. Considering the propensity for size, the interceptor fighter aircraft, the carrier-sized vessels that doubled as surface and submarine warfare vessels, even the acreage of the Pearl Harbor base itself, the conference room was rather small, even appearing crowded. Video screens dominated three of the four walls, showing maps, intelligence overflight photos, and the like. A podium, apparently equipped with sophisticated electronics that enabled the speaker to utilize any or all of the screens individually or simultaneously, dominated the fourth wall, into which were set the pneumatic double sliding doors through which the room was accessed. There were more names and faces than he could at this point in time differentiate, and the name tags on each person's respective uniform obviated the necessity for memorization. John Rourke listened instead of talking. The current speaker was a Marine colonel, introduced as being in charge of physical security for the island of Oahu in general and Pearl Harbor specifically. He was generously built, broad-shouldered and tall, with a haircut so short in comparison to those of his fellow officers that he looked as though he'd slipped through a time warp from the 60s.
Depending on their choice weaponry, we could experience unacceptably severe casualty levels. Eden's gas capabilities have been talked about. There have been tantalizing hints, but nothing definite. If they use chemical agents, we just flat out don't have enough protective gear available. And unless they hold off on attacking for the next 6 months, we would never have enough equipment to protect the civilian population. The question, it seems, is how we can interdict enemy action rather than respond to it. I'll open the floor to comments or what have you before I go on here.
Colonel?
General Rourke, yes, sir.
John Rourke had almost given up on encouraging people to stop calling him General, so he ignored it.
You spoke before about computer models.
Yes, sir.
Wouldn't the Eden Defense Force's strategic planners have access to your computer modeling programs? I mean, in their generic form?
I hadn't thought of that, sir.
My point, Colonel, is that if we stay with computer models, can't the enemy obviate any effectiveness such counterplanning might have by simply running the same basic programs, only more completely? I mean, we'll be guessing at many of the details, of course, unless your medical personnel can get information on our guest, Martin Zimmer. But from the briefing I went through, it wouldn't seem the sitreps Kronberg and the other SS personnel are running are that detailed. So, we should probably assume they'll have a better grasp of their plans than we will, which means their computer models can be more complete. They should be able to anticipate and plan for countering every move we'd make.
I never thought of that, sir. We could use computer models and...
When I was in the intelligence profession, several years before the night of the war, of course, we had a similar problem. I know a very fine gentleman who wound up in the intelligence profession, or perhaps counterintelligence is more apt, when he was little more than a boy. He stuck with it in one manner or another throughout his entire life. He once remarked to me that the problem in strategic planning was that none of the planners were doers. That was possibly a bit harsh a criticism, but the fact remains that he was making an interesting point. Now consider this. If you and your enemies use similar or perhaps even identical programs, you're planning around each other. And everything is conventional because all the responses are from the computer, and that means everything it will come up with has been thought of and used or discarded before. You're limiting your options. Why?
Why, sir?
Why?
Well.
Oh, I can take it, Colonel. Why?
The Colonel looked as though he felt a bit awkward. Rourke knew he was being nasty, but he had to make a point.
That's the way it's done, sir.
Has anyone in this room, aside from members of my family, of course, ever killed anyone? Let's see some hands.
No one raised a hand.
Has anyone ever met an enemy agent, other than during a social function?
No hands.
Has anyone ever been part of a combat situation, other than exercise?
No hands. John Rourke smiled, but said nothing else. The Colonel didn't speak for a moment.
Then are you suggesting, sir?
I didn't mean to put you on the spot, Colonel, and this is really none of my business, I suppose. I was very impressed with your briefing. I mean that sincerely. I thought that a point needed to be made, and unfortunately, you wound up as the scapegoat. That point is, if we want to stop the saboteurs and the commando teams we're expecting here, the best way might be to outthink them, rather than try to outcompute them, possibly in vain.
Someone to Rourke's right started to applaud. This meeting was more to John Rourke's liking. One colonel in charge of security, his name was Roy Staddard, was present, as was a naval psychiatric specialist, Helen Stickley, the commander of the SEAL team based out of Pearl, Lieutenant Commander Grant Washington, and Fleet Admiral Hayes, barely off her personal interceptor from Midwake. Admiral Hayes spoke.
Dr. Rourke, like it or not, you're still on the payroll. Your salary had been accumulating and earning interest for 125 years. You are a millionaire several times over. But my point, General, is that I do have the right to order you to stay physically uninvolved with these coming matters. You are, sir, a national treasure.
Don't be ridiculous, Admiral. And what am I going to do with all that money?
The money is your problem. Build yourself another survival retreat if you want, but you are a national treasure. As such, I cannot allow you to risk your life.
No disrespect meant, Admiral, but no one allows or disallows me to do anything of which I'm able. I can be of help here, and unless you attempt to force your will upon me, I intend to help.
If I get you killed?
If I die, it's my own fault, not yours. So, can we get back to the matter at hand?
She nodded only, then looked at the psychiatrist.
Doctor, you have results?
Yes, Admiral. I personally supervised the administration of several rather powerful truth-inducing drugs to Martin Zimmer, after, of course, running him through a thorough physical examination. The transcript of text should come up on that screen.
Helen Stickley gestured toward a large screen on the far wall of Admiral Hayes' office. John Rourke reflected that a television repairman could well have made a fortune these days with the proliferation of video and computer screens for information dissemination. Martin Zimmer's face appeared on the screen in reasonably tight close-up, his words, occasionally unintelligible, scrolling away across the bottom of the screen beneath his face.
Part of the time, and that's usual under these circumstances, Mr. Zimmer's speech appears slurred and unintelligible.
Can we fast forward into the part you mentioned, Doctor?
Dr. Stickley was a civilian, but evidently well used to the military. She touched a control on the arm of her chair, and the presentation started moving at what Rourke estimated was roughly 3 times normal speed. The scrolling was impossible to read, and Martin Zimmer's face looked almost funny, but not quite. Then the tape returned to normal speed.
Long on the Senate. A house on Sebastian's Reef.
Dr. Stickley paused the tape.
Sebastian's Reef, Dr. Rourke, is named after Commander Sebastian, later Admiral Sebastian.
Mm-hmm. I knew the gentleman.
It's a rather exclusive civilian enclave on the far side of the island.
Numerous estate-sized houses set within a natural enclave of woods. I was going to recommend to you that you might consider that area, Dr. Rourke. You could afford it.
The house is the headquarters for the SS sabotage units on Oahu, Cronenberg said once.
Only this man Cronenberg mentioned it? Did you discuss this with anyone else in your organization? Answer the question, Martin.
Nobody. Dad thinks that...
He is referring to someone named Dietrich Zimmer, Dr. Rourke.
I realize that.
Dad thinks that the fewer details any of us know, the less chance for a leak.
Dad was right.
Lieutenant Commander Washington looked to the Admiral.
Admiral, may I make a suggestion?
Certainly, Mr. Washington.
Ma'am, I think we could mount an operation against that house right now, and not only interdict some of their plans, but perhaps get a line on future activities. Maybe throw a monkey wrench into their timetable a little.
This isn't a classic military operation, Admiral. If we hit in military fashion, we'll get them, but they'll have the opportunity to burn or degauss every record they've got. We'll wind up with some people, some weapons, and very little information. If what Martin Zimmer is saying is true, then most likely little of the information that might be stored there is in the heads of whoever we might net.
What are you suggesting?
Before the night of the war, in addition to teaching and writing concerning survivalism, as you may know, I also taught special weapons and tactics, usually to counter-terrorist units, occasionally to police special response teams, SWAT teams, etc. What I propose is that Mr. Washington SEAL Team people, in conjunction with some of your security cops, be mobilized into the sort of operation we used to run when those teams were hitting a terrorist safe house or on a big drug bust. If we go in there and attack, we'll miss much of the value the raid could provide.
Yeah, my people are ready, Admiral.
Admiral Hayes stared at John Rourke. He stared back, and she smiled.
So you've made yourself the indispensable man, haven't you, Doctor?
Hopefully.